Hi, this is Colin McCallan. Thank you for listening. Please do us a favor and leave us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. Thank you.
Welcome to Is This Legal? Here are your hosts, attorneys Colin McCallan and Russell Hebbets.
Greetings and salutations to you faithful listeners out there. This is attorney Colin McCallan. As always, I'm joined by my partner in crime, Russell Hebbets. How are you today, Russ?
I'm kicking butt today.
It's Groundhog Day. That's always something to be excited. Do you know if Punxsutawney Phil saw a shadow?
He did.
What does that mean again?
Actually, I know that we're supposed to have an early spring. I think that means he saw his shadow, but I know that the groundhog said we're going to have an early spring.
Oh, he actually came out and said that at a press conference?
Yeah, well, he said he actually made some comments through an intermediary.
Oh, like there was an interpreter.
Groundhogs do real good sign language.
That's okay, so there were other groundhogs making sure that the message got clear. All right, well, that's good that they all chipped in together. So, guys, welcome back to another Is This Legal? We're going to be talking about what we think is a pretty fascinating case going on right now as we speak in Michigan. There's a jury trial going on there a woman by the name of Jennifer Crumbly is on trial for involuntary manslaughter. And this is very, very unusual because Jennifer Crumbly didn't kill anyone. She didn't pull a trigger. Yet she is on trial for the murder of 4 people. And here's what happened. Jennifer Crumbly is the mother, Russ, of Ethan Crumbly. Ethan Crumbly was a 15-year-old student, now 17, but 2 years ago in Michigan, he brought a gun to school, and he ended up killing 4 of his classmates in school. Horrible mass shooting, very, very sad. But he has already been dealt with. He is serving life without the possibility of a parole sentence. But now his mother is on trial. Russ, can you tell us why Jennifer Crumbly is on trial?
She is on trial, and actually her husband, Ethan's father, James, is also charged with 4 counts of involuntary manslaughter, and they are both charged under the legal theory that they should have picked up on signs that Ethan was mentally disturbed and was going to commit violence against students. They did nothing about it. And therefore, that inaction is what led directly to the students' deaths, the tragic killing of these 4 students. And so the prosecution is saying, you, Jennifer Crumbly, are responsible for their deaths, and you should be convicted of manslaughter in this case.
Yeah, they're essentially saying that Jennifer and her husband, James, acted with gross negligence. They basically, their conduct was so callous as to the sanctity of human life with regard to what their son did, that they have been charged, and the prosecution is trying to hold these 2 individuals responsible, partially responsible, I should say, for the deaths of these 4 people.
And I'll say for anyone out there who's thinking that, hey, this is unbelievable. You can't possibly hold a parent responsible for something like this. The defense had the same thought, and they actually appealed these charges to the Michigan Court of Appeals, and a 4-judge panel from the Michigan Court of Appeals ruled that the outcome, i.e. the mass shooting and the deaths, was reasonably foreseeable, and the case would not be dismissed.
Russ, can we go back a little bit? Can you give us a little bit of a recap of what happened on that fateful day, just so we can have a better understanding of where the prosecution's going with regard to James and Jennifer here?
Sure. We'll start at that day and then kind of go back. So there were some really, really blatant signals that day that Ethan Crumbly was mentally disturbed, that he was having possibly a psychotic break. So here's what happened. On the day of the shooting, he is in math class, and he is drawing on a piece of paper, and what he draws is a picture of people prone with blood everywhere and writing on it. And
he even wrote blood everywhere.
He wrote blood everywhere, and he wrote, "The thoughts won't stop. Help me." like not, this is not a subtle cry for help.
Right.
This is as explicit and as troubling as it can get. And so the math teacher saw this and brought him into the office, called the parents in. So Jennifer and James Crumbly came in. They sat down with the administration. I assume there was a school counselor or something like that there. And they had a meeting about this. And the school, out of that meeting, the school said, "We'll let you decide what you do with Ethan today, but we are directing you within 48 hours to get him mental health therapy."
Right. Now, there's a dispute here about whether or not there was a request by the school for the parents to take Ethan home that day, or whether they resisted that request, whether the request was even made.
Right.
What we do know is that these people, the parents as well as the school brass, decided Ethan could stay in school that day.
Right.
Of course, unbeknownst to them, the tragedy is that he had already brought a backpack with a gun to school that day and ended up opening fire on four students. Well, he shot several students. Four of them were killed.
Yeah. And I was unclear on whether he went home and came back with a gun or had the gun at that time. I don't know if they searched him. It seems like it would be really remiss.
I thought he had it because based on the information that's out there, when the news of the shooting got loose, Jennifer Crumbly basically testified that she tried to text Ethan, couldn't get a hold of him. And then she got a text from her husband saying that his gun is missing. So that leads me to believe that he had brought the gun to school earlier that day. Not totally sure on that, but
yeah, that could be significant as to like expanding the liability to potentially the school. And I want to talk about that a little later in the podcast, but in any case, this tragic thing happened, but so that day was the most stark example of him needing help and begging for help before committing this heinous crime. But there were things that happened before, and all of these things are coming out in this Jennifer Crumbly trial that's going on right now. Mm-hmm. So here are some of the things that the prosecution has brought up. There were a series of texts between Ethan and his mom, where Ethan is talking about the fact that the house is haunted, that there's a demon in the house, that the demon is throwing things around. So essentially showing paranoia and hallucinations, and the mom has to answer these, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And her answer is essentially, he's always been sarcastic. He's always joked that the house is haunted. I didn't take this seriously.
Right.
Right. Then there's this journal that he kept, and the journal says his parents wouldn't help him.
Yeah, he wrote in his journal that, hey, my parents won't help me with my issues.
Right.
And, that's something the prosecution is obviously trying to make a big deal out of. What does Jennifer say about that?
I didn't know. Right. I didn't read his journal.
Right.
I had no notice of this.
That's exactly right.
Right?
And honestly, it's plausible.
It is.
Most parents don't go around reading their kid's diary.
And most kids don't go around sharing their diary with their parents.
Well, I don't know if most kids have a diary in the first place. Are diaries still a thing these days? I guess I know some journalers, but I don't remember the last time I was talking to someone where they're like, "Oh, excuse me, I've got to go make a diary entry."
I think the vernacular has changed, but journal, you write things down.
Right.
But it's as a parent, we're both parents of two kids. Like, even just to get out of your kid what happened at school today, it's like get a crowbar out and just like put all your weight into it. Just pop this kid open to say something, right?
That's a very good point.
So, and then the last thing is there's apparently a text or a series of texts between Ethan and a friend of his, again saying his parents won't give him mental health help.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the gun for a second, because honestly, in a way, that's kind of the elephant in the room in this case, because I'm sure we're almost 10 minutes in this podcast. I'm sure many of you listeners have been wondering what I first wondered when I heard this case is, why does a 15-year-old kid have a gun that would be legally purchased from your parents? That's unusual. Or is it? I kind of want to talk about what I think might be kind of a cultural divide here. This case is being tried in Michigan.
Yeah.
Russ, I was thinking, we were talking about this before we started recording. Like, I can see a trial like this having completely different outcomes depending on where it's tried. Like, if this case were maybe tried in Portland or Seattle, you know, you might have a jury pool that just thinks that there should be no business for anyone under the age of 18 to handle a firearm, to be around a firearm. They're, you know, a very high level of, like, I guess, gun restriction is something you might encounter with a jury.
Right.
In those places, you go down to maybe somewhere in the South, though. I could see people saying, you know what, guns are a way of our life.
It's part of part of the culture.
You know, right. we actually want our kids to be familiar with the handling of guns as from a safety perspective, so that they know how to use them, so that they're familiar with them. And, you know, I think there's a lot of different views on how old your kids should be when they get a gun, whether they should ever get a gun in the first place. You know, that's part of our culture in this country.
Right. And here's where he got the gun. His dad or his parents bought him the gun 4 days prior. So this gun is new.
Yeah.
It is new. And it was the dad who, I believe it's the dad who bought the gun, and Jennifer Crumbly has testified. Yeah, it's the dad's.
Yeah, she was okay with it. She was like, yeah, go ahead and get the gun. It's more your thing, not my thing, is kind of what she said.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I think that kind of the gun, the culture of firearms in the area is important. And I grew up in Michigan. I know exactly where this is. This is Oxford High School. My best friend moved to very close to here his senior year. So this is probably an hour and a half outside of Detroit. It is not super urban at all, but it's also not out in the sticks, mm-hmm. you know? So there's some land out there. So I would think that in this area, there's probably more of a gun culture, but
yeah.
It's certainly not something where, you know, everyone
it's
would
pervasive.
Have. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Well, I think what you said earlier, a minute ago, is very important. I think it's a big fact that this gun was purchased just a few days before this incident. It's not like the gun was, you know, at home for a couple of years,
right.
where Ethan had demonstrated responsibility or
right.
care or, you know, ability to say, I can handle this gun safely. I mean, 4 days from date of purchase to date of incident, that is quick.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, clearly there were no precautions put into place to ensure that gun was handled safely.
Right.
There was no gun lock. There was no gun safe.
Right.
Right. Or if there was, he had access to it.
It also sounds like the parents were unaware of the gun's location until after the shooting. So, I mean, it's all of that is going to be prominently featured in this trial.
Yeah. And that's going to be a big part of the prosecution's case, is that this by its mere fact of what they did based on how this kid had these mental health issues was negligence.
A quick legal note. One reason that we think Jennifer is being tried separately from her husband, James, and that is the case. James' trial is going to happen sometime in March.
Right.
We think it's exactly because of this issue. We think that because Jennifer is saying, you know what, my husband was the one who actually purchased the gun. My husband was in charge of storing the gun. That is going to create a conflict of interest in their defenses.
Right.
So that's why they're having separate trials. They're not going to be tried together.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, that's a good defense.
Oh yeah.
Tool. Right.
Absolutely.
I mean, hey, I'm not the one who bought the gun. I'm
right.
not the one who, you know,
it allows
was responsible.
To blame her husband.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I wasn't responsible for the gun. The gun wasn't my deal. That
yep.
was, and the gun is what caused these deaths, right?
That's right.
Well, Ethan with the gun. So, you know, there's some other facts out here that the prosecution's going to use. You know, Ethan apparently told a friend that his parents, when he asked for mental health help, asked for a therapist, Ethan apparently told a friend that his dad said, "Suck it up," and his mom laughed.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's pretty bad. You know, the fact we talked about, the fact that the parents, that they left him in school. Now, she claims that he does better with peers than he does when he's alone. And because he was in that fragile state, she wanted him around other people. So that's her explanation of why she didn't take him out of school and keep him out of school. Now, the prosecution's going to turn around and say, "Are you kidding me? Look at this picture you just saw. This is a picture of a school shooting, and you leave this disturbed person in school." And right. you don't go check and see if the gun is still there, right. which was brand new.
Right.
Right. Like, that's strong for the prosecution.
Right.
So here's my question, Colin. You know, they're charged, both parents are charged with this involuntary manslaughter for their inability or inaction that caused this mass murder. What about the school? Like, why then? Because the school knew that the school saw this sheet. The school knew this was a disturbed kid. The school knew he wrote on it, "The thoughts won't stop, help me."
Mm-hmm.
And the school allowed him to be put right back into the school. What about the school liability?
I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I'm struggling to defend the school in the sense that I think they bear some partial responsibility from the standpoint that they obviously allowed him to stay in session despite these warning signs and the fact that maybe they should have searched his belongings.
That's huge for me.
You know, I mean, hindsight being what it is, could these people have known that he had a weapon that day? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, I think maybe this is going to be something where other schools can use going forward. They're going to adapt this to their protocol. If there's ever a suspicious incident in school, we're going to start searching our kids.
Yeah. And the two sides of it are, you know, one, how far can you extend this liability right. or this attempt? I mean, what about the gun shop? They sold it right. to the dad. Did they ask if it was for the son? Like, this could be never ending. So it's got to stop somewhere.
I mean, back to your question, I think where I can demarcate it in my mind is, you know, you're talking about responsibility for the school. Well, there's two types. There's criminal responsibility and then there's civil responsibility.
Right.
I don't think it is a good societal aim to go after schools like in a criminal capacity yeah. like this. It just doesn't feel right. I'm not saying the school bears no responsibility, and I think they might be exposed to a lawsuit, perhaps rightfully so. And maybe, like I said, this is going to have the effect of educating other schools and educators on how to handle the situation better. But man, I don't know. I don't like the idea of criminal liability for the school. I think the parents who are with this kid every single day, who control his position, who are in charge of buying him a gun or not.
Well,
I think those are all things that for me say, yeah, you can separate parents very squarely from the school. Now, I'm not saying that these people should be convicted. We'll talk about that later when we get to predictions. But
so for me, kind of one thing you struck on was the key point for me is the school, they did not know that he even had a gun.
Right.
They didn't know he had access to a gun. That is a huge point,
yeah.
right? The school didn't know that. The parents knew that, but the school didn't know that.
Right.
Now, should they have searched his bag? Probably. And again, I still hear what you're saying that it was there before. I saw something that said he might have gone home and come back with it. So
if that happened, then that's another failure somewhere.
Right.
I mean, either on the parents for letting him return or the school for allowing him to return.
Right. Yeah. So, but that is a key point for me as to whether or not the school is criminally liable. Right. But you know, you said, is it a good idea to go after school society? Societally for this, I'd ask the same question. Is it a good idea to go after parents? Right? Because,
So let's talk about the precedent portion of this, because a lot of the news articles that I've seen on this are calling this like a historic trial and possibly precedent setting. Let's be careful about that. I will say this. This does appear to be one of the first trials of its kind where right. we're going after the parent of a mass shooter.
I think it is the first,
you know, but that doesn't necessarily establish a precedent. I mean, prosecutors from all over the country can look at situations like this individually and decide whether or not they have evidence to suggest that there was gross negligence on the part of the parent or not. And again, the culture that you're coming from might really matter. Again, I think people are going to look at this case very differently if you live in New York versus Alabama.
Yeah. And what Colin's saying is it doesn't create a legal precedent,
right?
It doesn't create it doesn't require DAs to prosecute cases like this if this is successful.
But if it is successful, I think certainly they'll think about it.
I think so. So this does create, you know, a non-legal, a non-binding precedent where people may look at it and say, Well, you know what? I think we do want to create disincentive or incentive for parents to be more active in their kids, especially troubled kids' lives. And, you know, maybe we're going to try to send a message here and hopefully change
something
yeah. for the better that maybe prevents one of these in the future.
Yep. Well, Russ, in a minute, we're gonna take a break and we're gonna play Is This Legal? With you, the listener at home. But when we come back on the other side of the podcast, we're going to get a little bit more into the trial. Jennifer Crumbly is testifying. We're going to comment on whether or not we think that's a good decision or not. Of course, we're going to make predictions at the end to talk about what's going to be happening. I think closing arguments are today. So this trial could wrap up by the time this podcast is released. So,
yeah, pretty soon. We're going to talk about what the prosecution needs to prove, and we're going to talk about where Jennifer Crumbly was found by authorities when she was eventually arrested, which was not in Oxford, Michigan.
No, she went somewhere. So we'll talk about that. So on that cliffhanger, stay tuned for Is This Legal? We'll be right back.
It is time for us to play...
Is This Legal?
I mean, that was odd, but we'll roll
if
with
that
it.
If that didn't fire you guys up, I don't know what will.
Get you psyched.
Yeah, that was a weird one, but you know, let's leave it here so we can talk about how weird it is later.
So this is where we play a game show style game with you guys, where we read you a legal scenario and you guys tell us if it's legal or not.
So they know what's coming. They've been down this road before.
I mean, some of them have. we're getting tens of new listeners every episode, dude.
Well, for those of you maybe listening for the first time, we always use our friends Cornelius and Jebediah to illustrate our legal point. So without further ado, here is your fictitious legal scenario that we're going to ask you about. Officer Cornelius is patrolling the Northamptonshire streets when he sees his old nemesis Jebediah scream around the corner in a shiny new motor car. He pulls Jebediah over and asks for his license and registration, and Jebediah says, "Officer, I just purchased this car and I don't have my registration documents. I'm sorry that I was going so fast, officer." And in a very, very unusual move for Officer Cornelius, he decides to give a warning to Jebediah and lets him go. Now, 2 hours later, he gets a wire via the Pony Express that the car Jebediah, the motor car that Jebediah was driving, was actually stolen and was never purchased by Jebediah. So he goes and arrests Jebediah for two violations. He charges him with motor vehicle theft and perjury for lying to Officer Cornelius. Now, Jebediah hires his lawyer, Myrtle. She comes to his rescue, and at the preliminary hearing, Russ, Myrtle files a motion with the judge to dismiss the perjury charge. What should the judge do with that motion is the question. So, listeners...
Listeners, don't get hung up on the fact that he received a wire via Pony Express. Because, I mean, even though wires, by definition, are transferred via wire, this is the olden time where technologies were changing. So, I mean, wires were transported via the Pony Express. So don't get caught up. That's a red herring, people.
I don't really even remember how, like, the Pony Express works. There's just some dude on a horse, and he's just expressing across the country,
well,
right?
Well, no, it's different stations with a fresh horse at each outpost.
Oh, okay.
So you run the horse super hard, and when it's exhausted, you just hop on
another
new horse and run that. I mean, so you
It's
like you always have a fully charged horse.
Got it. Only multiple horses. Okay.
Right.
Thank you for the history of the Pony Express, yeah, Russ.
You're welcome.
I think that probably gave our listeners more than enough time to come up with their answer in this case. All right, so we are isolating, we're zeroing in on that perjury charge, right? We have Jebediah saying, "I just purchased this car and don't have the registration." So he's lying. We know he's lying to us.
We know he's lying.
Okay, so is he
committed
on the hook
perjury?
What's the answer, Russ?
The answer is That charge will be dismissed. He is not on the hook for perjury because perjury absolutely requires as an essential element that your statement be made under oath.
That's right. That's something that, you know, you see a lot of in like pop culture and in on TV. Oh, yo, he perjured himself. He lied. Right. Well, maybe. Perjury is actually a super hard charge to prove. Russ, have you ever handle the perjury case, like either defense or prosecution?
I've never seen one charged, but I'll tell you, like, it's something us attorneys think about all the time,
right?
Because, for example, like if Colin and I have a case and we're going to put our client on the stand in that case, we have to make sure that they're not going to lie when they're on the stand.
Yeah,
because if they lie when they're on a stand, that would be perjury, and not only could they be charged with perjury, we could be charged and lose our license for suborning perjury.
That is exactly right. So it's something that lawyers are very aware of, but it's very rarely prosecuted. It's very hard to prove. And anyway, the under oath thing is the key. You're not supposed to lie to a police officer, and honestly, that could expose you to criminal liability. There's things like false reporting to a police officer. You know, I'm not saying you can lie to the police, but it's not perjury is all we're saying, because unless that statement was made under oath. So Jebediah gets off on the perjury, but he's still hosed on the aggravated motor vehicle theft.
Yeah, I mean, he's probably has a defense that we didn't work out yet.
But yeah. So, yeah, it still comes up bad for Jebediah, but I think anyway. So thanks for playing at home. We are now going to get back to our regularly scheduled programming. We'll be right back.
Welcome back, everyone. Hopefully you got the answer correct to this week's episode of Is This Legal? So I'm taking us back, but we're coming back not to Oxford High School where this happened, but to Detroit, which is, as I said, maybe an hour and a half or so away. Why are we going to Detroit, Colin?
Well, the prosecution is making a pretty big stink about the fact that after this shooting, Jennifer and James Crumbly fled. They fled the area. Their son was arrested, and they got the heck out of Dodge and specifically headed to a warehouse in Detroit that's apparently some sort of art studio, and they were laying low there. So they got out of town, Russ.
Yeah, and so as we talked about it quite a bit in the Austin Road Cycle Love Triangle podcast, part one and two, the flight of a criminal defendant is admissible into evidence because it's admissible as evidence of guilt.
Now, wait a minute, Russ. The weird thing about that is they didn't even know they were going to be charged with a crime. What were they running from? I mean, they had, at that point, they had no criminal liability. It's not like there was a warrant out for their arrest.
When they fled, there was not. But there was while they were in Detroit. Like, they knew or should have known that authorities were looking for them and they were not turning themselves in.
I can tell you, too. I mean, really, the reality is, it doesn't necessarily matter if there was a pending criminal case against them, or if they should have known that they were a target of a police investigation. You can use their actions just as they are.
Right.
The fact is they fled. They got out of there. And, you know, the prosecution, of course, is trying to say that they did that because they were fearful of prosecution, that they didn't want to cooperate, and they were trying to maybe be obstructionists about this whole thing. Now, Russ, what do they say about that?
What they say is after this shooting, they were facing severe, significant, and very believable threats against their persons.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to get out of that community because obviously there were a lot of people who were very, very distraught about the death of kids. And for their own safety, they fled.
I'll tell you, that's very reasonable to me, Russ.
Yeah, it's
believable. Honestly, I mean, I in this day and age, if something like this happens, you can assume that media trucks, police are going to camp out in front of your house.
Families.
Yeah, like, yeah. You might be harassed. Members. I mean, I can actually understand their perspective on this. I'm not saying it was the right decision, but I think what they're saying is at least I get it.
Yeah,
I understand it.
Yeah, Jennifer Crumbly said I was planning to turn myself in. She didn't. They were apprehended in, I think it was an art warehouse in Detroit.
Right.
So who knows whether they would have turned themselves in or not, but that is a much better reason for fleeing than, you know, in the other case I just referenced where I'm a free spirit and I wanted to go to Costa Rica.
I mean, I can see the prosecution though, and I don't know if they're going to argue this, but I mean, this is a thought that came to me is, okay, you fled to Detroit. You abandoned your son when he might have needed you most. I mean, yeah, he was in custody, but what parent is going to like flee away from their kid in this situation if they really care about him? I mean, and that's honestly, that's one thing the prosecution is saying. They're playing some of her phone calls that she's made to relatives while she was in custody. And they're kind of talking about, she's talking about a GoFundMe page for fundraising to help her horses that are boarded. She's, you know, she's concerned about everything except for Ethan is essentially what they're saying. She didn't spend a lot of time talking about Ethan. So the prosecution is trying to use this information to make her look as callous as possible.
Well, let's talk about the defense. What's the defense saying? You know, what's the, you boil it down, the very bare bones of the defense and the foundation of the defense is that Jennifer Crumbly didn't know he was going to commit mass murder, so she didn't have a duty to act.
Absolutely.
That's it.
That's it. That's right. She had no idea that he was capable of this. She had no idea that he was going to do this. And, you know, this is a horrible, horrible tragedy that she's not responsible for. That's exactly what she's saying. And I think that's the right strategy.
Right.
I think, yeah. You know, so Russ, should we segue into the decision to testify? Are we ready for that yet?
Well, let's talk. So just a couple little pieces, more specifically, the defense is going to talk about how those texts that the prosecution's using to try to prove that, they're cherry-picked.
Right.
They're out of context. They're just single texts that are basically the prosecution is unfairly framing and they don't show the full picture.
Right.
Right? That's what they're saying. And then, as we talked about earlier, she's also going to say, hey, even if there was some sort of duty, the gun was not my responsibility.
Right.
So if anything, it was my husband. It wasn't me.
Right.
You know, so yeah, let's talk about her because you just said it. She's going to testify.
So,
or she is testifying.
Yeah. She is testifying. I think
today
she actually testified for several hours yesterday. And then she is wrapping up her testimony today. I think the cross-examination is today. Now, we were both doing a little research for this podcast, and we came across a USA Today article that was recapping this. And journalists sometimes reach out to law professors for their take on a situation, and that's what they did in this case. This is just a side story. I'm looking for the quote here. The USA Today asked a law professor, where is this guy? UCLA.
Adam Winkler.
Not
to be confused with Henry Winkler.
If the defendant would testify in this case. This was his response. It's criminal law 101. You do not allow the defendant to take the stand. It doesn't matter whether innocent or they're guilty. It's the last act of a desperate defense. Professor Winkler... I appreciate your opinion on this matter, but this is where I think academia and you're hanging out too long in academia, just you don't understand how to practically try a case and to make an emotional connection with jurors because his advice is flat out wrong in this case.
I mean, without a doubt, it's wrong in this case.
You, as the defense, you want to march this poor woman whose son has been locked up for the rest of his life for murder, who was estranged and is a co-defendant with her husband. This woman who's been in the media, she's been dragged through the mud. You want to march her up there and let her tell her story about how there's no way she could have known this was going to happen, that this was an abomination beyond anything she could have ever imagined.
Yep.
And you
she
let
had no
her
she had
be
no part,
emotional.
She had no part in it. And you absolutely have her gain the jury sympathy.
That's right.
And just, you know, throwing shade on
Professor Winkler.
Professor Winkler.
Professor. I'm using air quotes.
You know, I feel like for some reason the bad guy in Frosty the Snowman in the cartoon comes to mind. Wasn't his name Winkler? And wasn't he like a professor?
I'm thinking of Henry Winkler with the Fonz. Right, right. I mean, that's where my mind went.
Not to confuse with Henry Winkler, but that's the professor I'm picturing here. So I'm sure you don't look anything like the animated bad guy in the Frosty cartoon professor. But just to be fair, not all professors have that take. The USA article that we referenced,
USA Today,
they actually did get a quote from University of Michigan law professor Frank Vandervoort, who correctly and similarly to us said it makes perfect sense for her to testify specifically to gain that juror sympathy.
You just like him because he's a Michigan
man. I mean, all I'm saying is score one for Michigan and zero for UCLA.
We haven't talked about the fact you guys won a national championship, man. Are you still reveling in that?
Yes, we did. Yes, yeah. Michigan did. And that's going to last. I mean, that's going to keep me going for like a good 5 years.
I hope those Ohio State people are listening. Maybe they are going to have some hate mail for you.
Sorry, guys. I mean, you had the better of us for about a decade, but three in a row and a natty, that's a good start.
Now, back to this decision to testify. Now, with Professor Winkler, I will tell you, I mean, his thinking isn't necessarily wrong. There is what Russ and I think is kind of the old model of criminal defense, where there really is reluctance to want to put your client up on the stand.
Right.
But, you know, Russ and I have been studying this a lot over the last 10 years or so, and we're seeing a change. We're a sea change in how this is appearing. We do think that there can be a very significant emotional connection between a juror and a defendant.
Yeah.
That happens when the defendant testifies, warts and all. I mean, you know, Miss Crumbly is going to be up there and she's going to have to answer some tough questions,
right.
No doubt about it. She's not going to be up there like the perfect parent, but I think that's okay. I think the strategy from the defense is trying to say, you know what? She's no different than you or me.
Right.
She did the best she could in a really, really difficult, scary situation. She had no idea. We only know with the benefit of hindsight what could have happened. You know, so to criminally prosecute her for this conduct is just an overkill. And by the way, look at her and feel sorry for her.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so here's what the prosecution has to do. The key thing is they need two things. They need causation and negligence. So they need causation. Like, that's huge. They need to prove that Jennifer Crumbly's action or inaction in this case caused the death of those four students, and that inaction of hers was negligent.
Right.
Right? So they have to prove criminal negligence and causation. You know, so this is, there's been some other cases that are, no case like this, but some other ones that are a little similar. The closest one happened again in Michigan, and you have to go back to 2000, so over two decades ago, where a Michigan man pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter, the same charge, for leaving a gun in a shoebox that a six-year-old got and then shot a fellow classmate.
Okay. That's a completely different ball of wax,
right?
Because you're dealing with a six-year-old.
You're dealing with a six-year-old. You're dealing with leaving a gun on the floor where a six-year-old can get it. Like, and that one is much easier to get to that causation and the negligence than this case.
I agree. You know, one case that I thought of that we've covered on this podcast, it reminded me a little bit about this. We did an episode probably a couple years ago at this point, suicide by text. Remember that, guys? That was the case where there was a boyfriend and a girlfriend. These were teenagers. And the boyfriend was troubled. He had some mental health stuff going on. He was suicidal. And his girlfriend sent him multiple text messages basically encouraging him to commit suicide. You know, she was saying, just do it. Don't wimp out.
Right.
And he ended up committing suicide. And she ended up getting tried for her encouragement. And of course her defense was, well, I didn't do this. I didn't, you know, I she didn't do anything affirmatively that physically ended his life, but
right.
She was found liable. I know it's a completely different case, but it just kind of reminded me of that where you got a prosecutor's trying to hold someone responsible who wasn't even there, who wasn't even like at the scene when this happened.
Well, I'll tell you, that's the general trend across the country is to expand liability like that. And another example of that is there are now more and more prosecutions of drug dealers who sold drugs to people who overdosed.
Right.
Right. So again, you have a step away as far as causation, but you can still make that connection and you can still, people are being found guilty with that nexus being one more removed. So right. this is not surprising that this is happening, but it is the biggest stretch in this kind of case that has been tried.
Right. Yet. Right. I agree. So, as we mentioned, this case is going on right now. I think Ms. Crumbly might be the last witness, and they might be doing closing arguments. The jury could get this case later today. I mean, honestly, we might have a verdict by the end of today, based on what I'm seeing. So, Russ, is it time to make predictions?
I think it is. I think it's time to make predictions.
Speaking of predictions, for those of you who listened to our last trial, we made a couple of predictions about that. I do have to bring this up because one of us was right and one of us was wrong. You guys remember the driveway shooting that we covered in episode 109? Well, Kevin Monahan was convicted, and he was convicted of murder. He wasn't convicted of any lesser charges. No big deal, but that's what I predicted, and Russ predicted the exact opposite. That's really all you need to know about that.
I don't have anything to say.
But I think Russ is actually a very good prognosticator. So let's see if he can redeem himself with this one. Russ, do you think Miss Crumbly is going to be convicted of involuntary manslaughter?
So for me, this one is just barely too far for me. There's just not quite enough for me to say the jury can connect it, that the prosecution can connect it up enough to find her guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, I think that she has a lot of culpability. I think that if there's a civil case, she's probably going to be found culpable.
Right.
I think that she does. She's going to have to live with it. Like, right. I think she did miss things and she was just checked out. And I think she does have responsibility. I just don't think it's going to get there.
Before I make my prediction, I just realized we forgot to cover one little thing that came out during this trial. One thing the prosecution is making a big deal of is Miss Crumbly was apparently having an extramarital affair while this was happening. So she's married to James Crumbly, but she's having at least one extramarital affair, possibly multiple. She was on a dating app and she's meeting other people. The prosecution is using this information to show that she was distracted, that Ethan wasn't a priority, that she was basically involved in these romantic dalliances, and that's where her focus was. Russ, I am trying to decide if I like that strategy from the prosecution. To me, there's an argument that if a mom is having an affair, I don't know, that maybe she's a distracted parent. Is that something you can really argue, though, into why she should be responsible for this? I don't know. To me, that was kind of a weak argument and maybe a little bullying from the prosecution. But I don't know what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I looked at that, and when I saw it, I just thought it was a non-issue. Like, I didn't even spend any time digging into it because it just didn't seem to have that much relevance. Mm-hmm. And I understand what the prosecution's saying, which is what you said, which is she was distracted. She was just checked out, right? So maybe there's some use to it. I don't know that I would have gone there.
Yeah.
It does seem a little desperate. A little
desperate,
a little far-fetched. I mean, yeah. I hear what they're saying, but, you know, as a defense, you could turn around and say, this is all they have. They're trying to say that because she was having an extramarital affair, that she's responsible for the death of these four people. How desperate are they? How much of a reach is this?
I think that's exactly how they should handle it.
Yeah.
I think that's smart. Because that's kind of what I was thinking. You're really going after this lady for that? Like, right. Okay. So my prediction now, Russ, I'm going to agree with you. Okay. We're aligned on this one. I really, really difficult, sad case. And I'm not sitting here saying that Miss Crumbly did everything perfect. I think clearly she has reasons to be concerned, but kind of like you, I think there is enough of a disconnect between the fact that I don't think she was aware that her son had a gun that day. Maybe she should have been, but she wasn't. And I don't think that she really, it was on her radar what he was going to do. And that means something to me. And I'll tell you, I don't know if I will feel the same about James. Yeah. I mean, if I think it really, really matters that he got a gun from his father 4 days before he did this when he's age 15. I think that's critical. And I think it's very important that apparently Miss Crumbly was really not involved in that. I feel like that's why she might get acquitted. So that's my prediction. I think she's going to get acquitted.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see. And, you know, as you're listening to this, check your news alerts because you may be able to know right now if we're right or wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. So, interesting case. You know, do you guys have thoughts on this? Send us an email. It's definitely a thought provoker.
All right. So now that we've broken this down and given you our predictions, you know what it's time for, Colin?
Oh, I think it's time for something stupid, time for something really dumb.
Time for everyone's favorite episode or
what
segment.
Is it time for? DC!
OT!
Dumb
Joe!
The Dumb Criminal of the Week. I mean, some of you ask why we put this at the end, because some of you want to hear at the beginning. And of course, we need you to listen to our podcast.
Right, you okay? Get
you. Like you got, in order to, you have to be rewarded, okay?
Got to put in the work to get the, to reap the rewards.
Now, yes, we know there are some people who just fast forward through all of our main content just to get just, to that DCOTW.
Like, straight, you think so?
No, I don't, but you know.
It could happen.
Yeah, and if you are, you're a weirdo and you should be commended for it.
Yeah.
Russ, I think it's your turn this week, right?
It is. This week we are going to Grapevine, Texas. Hmm. We're gonna visit a gentleman by the name of Adan Juarez Ramirez. Now, Mr. Ramirez, he decided for some reason it would be a good idea to impersonate a police officer.
Okay. Can be fun sometimes.
So yeah, sure. I mean,
at costume parties,
Friday
say.
Night. Yeah.
So, or adult clubs. I mean, you know,
what he did is he outfitted his truck with an elaborate light system. It would be similar to something that undercover cop cars would use.
Okay.
He then drove down the highway and he decided to pull a driver over.
Okay.
So he got behind the driver, flipped on his lights. Now the driver suspected something was amiss. The driver did not pull over. The driver instead called 911.
Hmm.
Police responded. The actual police responded and they quickly pulled Mr. Ramirez over, where they found his elaborate homemade light system, or not homemade, his elaborate light system that he installed. They also found a homemade police ID card.
Okay.
So this presumably is what he was going to show people when he pulled them over.
It wasn't a badge?
It was a police card. It was not a badge. Now, this card or ID was not nearly as convincing as the lights, Colin. He had blacked out a restaurant gift card and etched the word police onto the card. It might have been more convincing, Colin, if he hadn't left the jalapeno pepper logo and the words Chipotle Mexican Grill on the top of the card that he was going to use to show people he was a police officer. So he was charged with impersonating a police officer with really no viable defenses.
Mm-hmm.
The cherry on top is that he also was illegally in the country, so he was put on an immigration hold and is now probably back south of the border,
right,
enjoying some jalapenos.
Wow. All right. So, he used a Chipotle gift card to create a fake police ID. Yeah. If I heard that.
That is what you heard correctly.
That honestly just is one of the stupidest things I've ever heard. And the fact that he did such a poor job of it and actually like left the logo in place.
Right.
Did he identify, like, did he actually?
He never actually got the guy pulled over. So he didn't even get that far.
what I would have done in his situation when I got pulled over by the real police, I would have said, oh, fellas, thank God you're here. I was afraid I was going to have to do this one alone. I don't know what's going on with the driver in front of me, but why don't you guys go talk to her?
He wouldn't stop. Just wouldn't stop for me.
Thanks for being here, backup. Yeah, that's pretty stupid. So this is where we have to rate our knuckleheads, our offender, by the way. What am I trying to say? We rate the stupidity of our offender using knuckleheads, 1 to 5 knuckleheads. Yeah. 1 being, this isn't so silly. 5 being, this is ridiculous. 5 for me.
Yeah.
You know, I don't see any redeeming qualities here. You're doing everything wrong and really everything stupidly. While you're in the country illegally, you just need to go somewhere else.
I mean, pretty much every step of the way, it was stupid, 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 stupid. Even the lights, which apparently were pretty convincing, weren't convincing enough.
Right, to where a motorist looking behind is right. Like, that's no cop.
Right, that's a migrant in a beat-up pickup truck.
So, yeah, I think that's pretty stupid, Russ, so yeah, I'll give him 5.
5 for me, too.
Okay.
Yeah, so 10 for you, Mr. Ramirez.
Perfect 10, Mr. Ramirez. Nicely done. All right. Well, I think we'll end on that note. Russ, how can people find us?
You can find us, as I said earlier, email denvercrimelaw@gmail.com, on Facebook at Hebbets McCallan, on X at Is This Legal Pod. And we are not on Instagram, so don't look for us
our
there.
Our pretty faces aren't there.
Nope. We should be.
Yeah, no, we should.
We're idiots.
I know. Well, you know, we're also tech non-savvy and don't like that stuff, so I don't know.
I mean, speak for yourself.
Well,
like a tech wizard over here.
Maybe I'll go check out your Insta, lady, that you're keeping secret from me. All right, guys. Well, thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Is This Legal? See you next time.
Johnny Law looked at me, said, Jebediah, can't you see them things you're doing just ain't right? Going around this town, stirring up a fright. Won't get far driving in your motor car. Look Cornelius right in the eye. Said you ain't got proof. I ain't the guy.